Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, we present new clinical trials on immunotherapy for stage 3 mismatch repair deficient colon cancer, early surgery for asymptomatic aortic stenosis, an approach to dengue virus suppression, and advances in gene and prime editing therapies for rare disorders. We also review mini puberty. We follow the case of a 12-year-old girl with altered mental status and persistent hypoglycemia. And we explore perspectives on corporate influences on health, vaccine communication, antitrust policy, conflicts of interest, and the meaning of the number needed to treat. Atezolizumab plus FOLFOX for stage 3 mismatch repair deficient colon cancer. By Frank Sinicrope, from the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota, and co-authors. Standard adjuvant chemotherapy for stage 3 colon cancer consists of a fluoropyrimidine plus oxaliplatin regimen. This phase 3 trial evaluated whether the addition of atezolizumab, an anti-programmed death ligand 1 agent, to a modified FOLFOX 6 regimen, fluorouracil, oxaliplatin, and leucovorin, called M-FOLFOX6, would improve outcomes in patients with stage 3 colon cancer with mismatch repair deficient DMMR status. Approximately 700 patients with resected stage 3 DMMR tumors were randomly assigned to receive either adjuvant atezolizumab plus M-FOLFOX6 for 6 months, with atezolizumab continued as monotherapy for a total of 12 months of therapy, or M-FOLFOX6 alone for 6 months. The addition of atezolizumab to M-FOLFOX6 significantly improved disease-free survival among these patients. Adverse events of grade 3 or 4 occurred in 84.1% of the patients who received atezolizumab plus M-FOLFOX6 and in 71.9% of those who received M-FOLFOX6 alone. Deb Schrag from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, New York, writes in an editorial that the results of this trial provoke two key questions. First, is chemotherapy even necessary to treat DMMR tumors? This question would not have been feasible to address when the trial was launched in 2017. But in 2020, the KEYNOTE-177 trial showed that immunotherapy alone was superior to chemotherapy as first-line treatment for DMMR metastatic colon cancer. Second, the trial did not address how neoadjuvant compares with adjuvant immunotherapy. Neoadjuvant immunotherapy and the omission of FOLFOX should both be evaluated in future trials targeting DMMR colon cancer. The trial by Sinicrope and co-authors is a victory in the 30-year odyssey to maximize cure and minimize toxicity while walking the tightrope between undertreatment and overtreatment for stage 3 colon cancer. However, as insights into the distinctive responsiveness of molecular subgroups advance, the era of large-scale two-group trials of adjuvant therapy is receding and will eventually disappear. Next-generation studies need to harness the power of trial networks to build platforms with infrastructure to measure and monitor biomarkers and to customize curative intent treatments that are based on better understanding of tumor biology and individual risk. Early surgery or conservative care for asymptomatic aortic stenosis at 10 years by Duk Yun Gang, from the University of Ulsan, Seoul, South Korea, and co-authors. Among asymptomatic patients with severe aortic stenosis, a previous analysis showed that the risk of a composite of death during surgery or within 30 days after surgery, called operative mortality, or death from cardiovascular causes was significantly lower with early surgery than with conservative care. However, the long-term survival benefit of early surgery as compared with conservative care remains unclear. In this trial, 145 asymptomatic patients with very severe aortic stenosis were randomly assigned to undergo early surgery or receive conservative care. The patients were followed for 10 years. Early surgery led to a lower risk of a composite of operative mortality or death from cardiovascular causes than conservative care at 10 years. Dengue virus suppression by male Wolbachia-infected mosquitoes by Ju Tao Lim from the Nanyang Technological University, Singapore, and co-authors. Dengue is a growing vector-borne disease globally. In the past decade, the number and magnitude of dengue virus outbreaks have grown steadily. Wild-type female Aedes aegypti mosquitoes that mate with male A. aegypti mosquitoes that have been infected with Wolbachia pipientis bacteria produce non-viable offspring owing to cytoplasmic incompatibility. Repeated release of sterile Wolbachia-infected males can potentially suppress wild-type mosquito populations and reduce the risk of dengue virus infection. This trial involved the release of sterile male A. aegypti mosquitoes infected with Wolbachia bacteria for the control of dengue in Singapore, a tropical city-state. In this cluster randomized trial with test negative controls, 15 geographic human population clusters were divided into two groups. 8 clusters received deployments of male Wolbachia-infected mosquitoes, and 7 clusters received no deployments, the control clusters. The primary endpoint was the diagnosis of symptomatic dengue virus infection of any severity caused by any serotype of the virus. More than 300,000 residents lived in each cluster. Adult wild-type A. aegypti populations were suppressed across the intervention clusters. Release of sterile Wolbachia-infected male A. aegypti mosquitoes reduced vector populations and the risk of dengue infection in Singapore. AAV9 gene therapy in type 2 GM1 gangliosidosis, a phase 1-2 trial by Connor Lewis from the National Human Genome Research Institute, Bethesda, Maryland, and co-authors. GM1 gangliosidosis is a rare neurodegenerative lysosomal storage disorder. Clinical manifestations involve the central nervous system. Type 1 GM1 gangliosidosis is the most severe type, and type 3 is the mildest. Patients with type 2 GM1 gangliosidosis have developmental delays, ataxia, dystonia, dysarthria, low bone mineral density, and progressive brain atrophy. 2 subtypes of type 2 GM1 gangliosidosis, late infantile and juvenile, have different clinical trajectories, but all patients have a progressive fatal course. GM1 gangliosidosis is caused by biallelic variants in GLB1 and results from deficiency of lysosomal beta-galactosidase, which degrades GM1 ganglioside. There is currently no effective therapy for this disease. In this phase 1-2 study, 9 children with type 2 GM1 gangliosidosis received a single intravenous infusion of adeno-associated virus serotype 9, AAV9, encoding beta-galactosidase. The gene therapy was associated with 124 adverse events, including severe vomiting in one participant and elevated liver enzyme levels in all participants. Secondary endpoint results suggested improvements in biochemical markers and neuroimaging patterns and stable or reduced rates of developmental deterioration in some measures. Prime editing for P47 Fox deficient chronic granulomatous disease by Jennifer Gorey from Prime Medicine, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and co-authors. Chronic granulomatous disease, CGD, is an inherited immunodeficiency affecting approximately 1 in 200,000 births. The condition is caused by variants in genes encoding subunits of the NADPH oxidase complex. The autosomal recessive P47 Fox deficient CGD is caused by damaging variants in NCF1 and accounts for approximately 25% of CGD cases in North America and Europe. The most common variant, a 2-nucleotide deletion in exon 2, Dell GT, is found in approximately 80% of persons with P47 CGD. These investigators developed PM359, an autologous CD34 hematopoietic stem cell therapy in which prime editing is used to correct Dell GT. Two participants received PM359 after myeloid conditioning with busulfan. Neutrophils and platelets engrafted promptly in both patients. Adverse events were consistent with myeloid conditioning with busulfan. Prime editing of autologous CD34 cells corrected the molecular defect in P47 CGD and restored neutrophil function to near healthy levels in the two participants. These results support further investigation of this approach as a therapeutic platform for CGD. Daniel Bauer and Stuart Orkin from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Boston, write that despite the success reported by Gori and co-authors, much work remains to be done if the promise of cure is to be realized for other patients with CGD and those with other inherited disorders. Therapeutic gene modification was first envisioned at the advent of the recombinant DNA era, but has taken decades of scientific developments to become feasible and effective. From a patient's perspective, such therapies are useful only if they are available and at a cost that society can afford. The elegant study by Gori and co-authors, taken together with approvals of other gene-based therapies for hemoglobin and immune disorders, highlights a dissonance between what science can deliver for patients and the economic realities of rare disease therapies faced by for-profit entities. Realization of the true value of gene modification for patients will require creative solutions to this dilemma. Clinical Implications of Mini-Puberty. A review article by Anders Juhl from the Copenhagen University Hospital, Rigshospitalet, Denmark. Mini-puberty refers to a specific period in early postnatal life with high activity of the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal HPG hormone axis. In infant boys, 1 to 3 months of age, high concentrations of follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone are released, which results in high levels of gonadal hormones from testicular Leydig cells, testosterone and insulin-like 3, and Sertoli cells, inhibin B and anti-Müllerian hormone. The HPG axis is also active in infant girls who have adult levels of follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone during this period. Immediately after mini-puberty, the HPG axis is silenced for approximately 10 years and is reactivated only with the onset of puberty. Thus, mini-puberty represents an early window for diagnosing disorders of sexual differentiation and rare endocrine disorders such as congenital hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, and may help guide dosing of therapeutic interventions, including gonadotropin therapy. Of note, mini-puberty predicts adult reproductive capacity. This review summarizes our current understanding of mini-puberty and describes its potential clinical implications. A 12-year-old girl with altered mental status and hypoglycemia, a case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Catherine Lord and colleagues. A previously healthy 12-year-old girl was brought to the emergency department after her mother had difficulty rousing her. When she awoke, she could not maintain her gaze and was speaking nonsensically with intermittent periods of stupor. Her blood glucose level was 30 milligrams per deciliter. Her mental status improved after intravenous glucose, though hypoglycemia persisted despite continuous dextrose infusion. In the preceding months, her mother had noticed early satiety. On examination, her abdomen was distended with a mass-like fullness in the pelvis. Imaging revealed a solid, enhancing, intraperitoneal abdominopelvic mass that measured 28 centimeters by 21 centimeters. While awaiting diagnosis, the patient required frequent meals, glucose monitoring, and nighttime intravenous dextrose. After surgical resection of a 5-kilogram tumor, her glucose level normalized immediately. Corporate vectors of chronic disease, using internal industry documents to craft counter strategies. A Medicine and Society article from the Consortium of the Center to End Corporate Harm, University of California, San Francisco. Chronic or non-communicable diseases, which include cancers, diabetes, neurocognitive disorders, and chronic respiratory disease, account for 74% of global deaths. In the United States, between 1990 and 2021, risk factors linked to commercial activity contributed to an increase by 175% in the incidence of cancer, 283% in diabetes, 133% in Parkinson's disease, and 75% in Alzheimer's disease or dementia. Globally, five commercial products are key factors in 31% of all deaths each year. Fossil fuels contribute to 8.1 million deaths, tobacco to 7.2 million, ultra-processed foods to 2.3 million, chemicals used in commerce and pesticides to 1.8 million, and alcohol to 1.8 million. An additional 600,000 deaths globally are attributable to drug use or overdose, primarily cases involving opioids. These authors believe that the medical and health fields should prioritize research on and communication about risks to health associated with corporate and commercial activity. One key approach is increasing transparency regarding corporate funding of research. A second strategy is to hold corporations to academic standards of data sharing and open science. Third, governments could prohibit financial ties between industry and researchers. Fourth, policymaking should be safeguarded from corporate influence. And finally, scientific peer review bodies and scientific advisory committees should be free from conflicts of interest. Communicating about vaccines in a politically contentious climate. A perspective by Douglas Opel from the University of Washington School of Medicine, Seattle, and Sean O'Leary from the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus, Aurora. On January 5th, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services changed the childhood vaccine schedule, reclassifying several vaccines from routinely recommended to requiring shared decision-making between parents and clinicians. How should clinicians communicate with parents about childhood vaccines in this contentious climate? It may be helpful to remember what has remained constant. Pediatric clinicians have been and continue to be parents' most trusted source of reliable information about vaccines. It is important that clinicians both draw on this trust and nurture it. Pediatric clinicians should be careful about expressing a political stance or making overt political references in their vaccine discussions with parents. To avoid alienating parents and eroding trust, pediatric clinicians should engage about politics only when parents voice their own political views and should do so only to learn more about how those views are influencing their vaccine decision-making. Pediatric clinicians can continue to strongly recommend vaccines that have a shared decision-making designation. Clinicians should expect to field questions from parents regarding the new vaccine schedule. Responses should be simple and jargon-free. Pediatric clinicians could focus on the fact that the American Academy of Pediatrics vaccine schedule has not changed. Playing favorites. State protection of academic medical centers from antitrust oversight. A perspective by Jamie King from the University of Auckland, New Zealand, and co-authors. U.S. academic medical centers, AMCs, institutions that provide clinical care, support research and innovation, develop and validate new products and care pathways, and educate and train clinicians, have increasingly merged with non-academic hospitals and healthcare systems. These transactions reflect broader trends in the healthcare market, where consolidation has been occurring for decades. AMCs provide tertiary and quaternary care, making them must-haves for insurer networks and granting them substantial market power. They are also large employers that typically have strong reputations and community ties, resulting in political and reputational power. Mergers involving AMCs offer distinct opportunities to improve patient care and health outcomes, but they also pose risks of price increases and other competitive harms. Increasing awareness of the consequences of consolidation for healthcare consumers and the market has prompted an uptick in state and federal antitrust oversight and enforcement. In several states, however, policymakers have exempted AMCs affiliated with state university systems from antitrust review. These authors believe these policies are problematic. Regulators should carefully review all transactions involving an AMC and negotiate conditions to help ensure that approved transactions deliver on promised benefits while minimizing harms to the public. Conflict of interest in advisory committees, facts, fallacies, and the limits of reform. A perspective by Genevieve Cantor from the University of Southern California, Los Angeles. The 2025 strategy report from the Make America Healthy Again, MAHA Commission, outlines how the U.S. Departments of Health and Human Services, HHS, intends to deliver on the Pledge to Reduce Conflicts of Interest, COIs, on its advisory committees. HHS will require advisory committee members to recuse themselves from matters that affect their financial interests and will mandate recusal requirements consistent with the Federal Advisory Committee Act, the 1972 law governing advisory committee operation. What exactly do these promises mean, and can they restore public trust in HHS? As written, the proposed reforms signal either historic change or plodding incrementalism. Even the most radical interpretation of MAHA's proposals, however, is unlikely to restore public trust. There is an outsized gap between what the public wants from its health regulators, agencies free of industry influence, and the government's constricted approach to COIs. To restore trust, HHS must fortify the integrity of agency decision-making in all its actions, providing comprehensive scientific justification for its decisions, ensuring transparency in its meetings and negotiations with industry, and diligently enforcing existing rules, as well as implementing meaningful COI policies. Such a self-reinforcing ecosystem should incorporate mechanisms for collecting evidence on the effectiveness and impact of COI policies. Number Needed to Treat, a perspective by W. Michael Broad from the Dell Medical School at the University of Texas at Austin. The math feels exact, reassuring even, a tidy bell curve, outcomes clustering politely around a mean. Yet patients don't think of themselves as statistics. They behave like people. They spike, flatline, wander off against medical advice, and sometimes beat the odds of survival. They are all counted in the intention to treat analysis. Enter the mighty NNT, the number needed to treat. The numerator is always noble and small. One, the single patient breathing in front of us. The denominator is the absolute benefit, or whatever approximation we're willing to hang a white coat on. Ask, does this pill work? We can answer, straight-faced, if 286 people swallow a statin for 5 years, one of them will live a little longer. There is only so much we can control, and much of that is placebo. Still, the bell curve nags. There is always someone who camps out in the tail, proving the rule by breaking it. That's why every doctor buys tail coverage, not just insurance, but the reflexive complete blood count at dawn, the just-in-case CT scan, the extra consult that begins with recommend consideration of. We call it evidence-based prudence. Really, it's actuarial superstition. We shake our confidence into narrow intervals and pretend what falls within them is solid. Research shows the extra test rarely changes the outcome, yet the last CT that did save a life still flashes in our hippocampus like a billboard reading, "I am not a data point." The statistics never tell the full story. This author, Dr. Broad, developed something akin to clinical faith, the belief that experience, intuition, and a stubborn regard for outliers still count as evidence. He cultivates a quiet, almost ritual wish that each order written, each hand held, each guess disguised as a probability might receive, for this one patient, the absolute benefit of the doubt. Not because the math demands it, but because a whole person heals, and he is able to believe that the bell curve bent precisely where it needed to. So Dr. Broad keeps hoping that amid all our futile and uncertain labor, everything we do has an NNT of one. In our images in clinical medicine, a 33-year-old pregnant woman with previously controlled atopic dermatitis presented with 3 days of fever and an itchy, painful rash. Erythematous vesiculopapular lesions were noted on the face, neck, chest, and arms. PCR testing of fluid from a vesicle on the neck was positive for herpes simplex virus type 1, HSV-1. A diagnosis of eczema herpeticum was made. This secondary infection of eczematous skin, most often atopic dermatitis, is caused by HSV-1. The condition typically occurs on skin affected by the underlying dermatosis. In another image, a woman with Bell's palsy presented with a 1-month history of involuntary facial movements. Her face was nearly symmetric at rest, but when she raised her eyebrows, one side of her mouth involuntarily lifted, shown in a video at nejm.org. A diagnosis of facial synkinesis was made. Facial synkinesis is a sequela of facial nerve injury during which involuntary movements of the facial musculature occur with voluntary movements. In a third image, a woman with a history of necrotizing pancreatitis presented with abdominal pain and fevers. CT showed a fluid collection with gas and septations in the pancreatic region. A diagnosis of walled-off pancreatic necrosis was made. This late complication of acute necrotizing pancreatitis is defined by the formation of an encapsulated collection of necrotic tissue and fluid. After initial treatment, the patient's condition did not improve. A retroperitoneal necrosectomy was performed, shown in a video at nejm.org. The patient was discharged home 3 weeks after surgery. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.